Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Unkindest Cut of All edition. It's Wednesday, June 20th, 2018. On today's show, Hereditary is the latest indie artsy horror flick. Does it continue the trend of terrifically taught low to mid-budget movie making that has elevated the genre to new commercial and artistic heights? We will discuss. And then The Staircase preceded the recent true crime frenzy initiated by Serial and The Jinx, a template to what has come since and still a classic in its own right. The whole remarkable show, including new episodes, is now available for greedy streaming. For that segment, we'll be joined by Staircase completist Rebecca Lavoie of the Mom and Dad Are Fighting podcast. And finally, there's only one The Bard, and there's only one The Isaac Butler. We bring them together for you today. Isaac discusses his new and marvelous Slate podcast, Lend Me Your Ears. Isaac, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you back. And of course, we have Laura Miller in the house, the book critic for Slate.com. Hey, Laura.
Hi, Steve.
All right. Well, Hereditary is the new art house hit horror film. It comes from the imagination of first-time writer and director Ari Aster. It's about a family deep in grief and their own codependency with one another. The action begins with the death of the grand matriarch, a troubled and complex woman whose legacy appears to be one of deep remorse and perhaps a strain of mental illness, the deep and murky tributaries of a family living with secrets and lies. That's really sort of the subject of Hereditary. It's filled with a lot of silence, plus there's a really cool Tudor-style house, I believe.
Oh, it's arts and crafts.
That's what I said, Laura, arts and crafts-style house. The movie stars Toni Collette and Gabriel Byrne. Why don't we listen to a clip?
You okay, Mom?
What?
Is there something on your mind?
Is there something on your mind?
It just seems like there might be something you want to say.
Yeah. Like what? I mean, why would I want to say something so I could watch you sneer at me?
Sneer at you? I don't ever sneer at you.
Oh, sweetie, you don't have to. You get your point across.
Okay, so fine, then say what you want to say, then.
Peter.
I don't want to say anything. I've tried saying
Okay,
things.
So try again. Release yourself.
Oh, release you, you mean?
Yeah, fine, release me. Just say it. Just fucking say it.
Don't you swear at me, you little shit. Don't you ever raise your voice at me. I am your mother. Do you understand?
All right, well,
there
we go, to dive in. I mean, Laura, this is a movie filled with misgiving and unspoken recrimination. That scene's just one example. It's it's, you know, this claustrophobic emotional economy of this family. Everyone feels regret vis-a-vis everyone else. I do think eventually at the center of the movie is the relationship between Toni Collette, the mother, an artist, a very frustrated artist, and her son. It becomes the central relationship. In movies, traditionally, a mother is really not allowed to express ambivalence about motherhood without becoming the villain of the piece. I think this movie was quite smart and self-conscious about that history and tried to trying to subvert it. What did you think?
Well, I would say that it's really hard to talk about this movie without talking about the ending, because there is an ambiguity to what's going on in the narrative that gets resolved in the ending. And depending on what you want from this kind of film, that will either please you or displease you. I prefer the state of mystery, and so I enjoyed most of the film up until maybe the last 5 or 10 minutes, because it was really exactly in the wheelhouse of my favorite kind of ghost story, really, which is the story where you can't tell if the central character, or in this case, characters, are haunted or mad. And that puts it, to my mind, up there with The Haunting, which was the first adaptation of Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House, not the terrible special effects cursed one that was made in the 80s. But the 1960 or 1963 version, I can't remember what the exact date was, but with Julie Harris, a fantastic performance by Julie Harris. And this is similarly has at the center this incredible performance by an actress. But also, I think the son is pretty amazing as well. You're wondering if what we're seeing is the literal heritage of mental illness, or some other kind of heritage that would be more sinister and occult. What happens in the story is that there's a family with a therapist father and an artist mother who specializes in making these dioramas, or basically they're like dollhouses, and the movie really announces its originality from the beginning by having the camera slowly zoom in on one of these little dollhouses on this room that at some moment where you can't really spot the exact moment becomes the real room where one of the children is sleeping and the father comes in and the dog. And it's really kind of magnificent, in my opinion, a magnificent ghost story up until the point that it starts to resolve into an explanation for what's going on.
Yeah, I think there's so much going on in this movie that is so well done and so great and so confident from essentially a group of early career artists, not counting Toni Collette and Gabriel Byrne. About Toni Collette, I will just say, how many more like truly brilliant performances does she have to give on camera before we're just like, yes, she's one of the best actresses alive? I mean, she is incredible in this movie. And I found her performance just like totally spellbinding and harrowing. This is one of the few horror movies I've been moved to tears by. Actually, in that dinner sequence, I was so upset by it. But also, it's a first-time film. Like, its director is a first-time. This is his first feature-length film.
Yeah.
His name's Ari Aster. He's incredible. The cinematography is by a relatively unknown cinematographer named Pavel Porgazelski. I apologize, Mr. Porgazelski, if I'm mispronouncing your last name. The score is by a relative newcomer named Colin Stetson, who is a musician on the Arrival score. Millie Shapiro plays the daughter as a newcomer. The actor who plays the son is, you know, he's born in 1997. So it's not like, you know, he's not a prolific actor yet. So it's all these folks who are like at the beginning of doing this, and they really kind of knock it out of the park for most of it. But I do think there is a thing where the themes, it's not just the story, the themes the movie appears to be really delving into around grief are actually misdirection for this other thing that's going mm-hmm. on.
Right.
And so while I found that other thing also upsetting and scary and everything like that, the earlier thematic exploration is way more interesting to me. I will also mm-hmm. say there is one piece of voiceover in the last 30 seconds of the movie that feels very studio notey. You have to tell us what was going on in this movie when the movie is already through visual grammar made it abundantly clear what the explanation is. And that is the sort of kind of exposition, as Laura said, I prefer mystery, where I was like, if you would just cut that, please just cut that in a director's cut. It's the only thing you have to cut. Just cut that.
Yeah.
But I was really taken with it. And I think it's worth seeing in a full theater so you can hear the audience begin to notice things in the frame and mm-hmm. get really freaked out by it.
Right. It's a very, very creepy, skin crawly movie. And it bypasses a lot of your conscious mind for most of it in ways that are profoundly unsettling. You know that you are in for a toss and turn night in your own bed when you go home. At the center of that, I mean, there are many elements to that, but to me, it was centrally the story of the ambivalent mother whose family has a history of mental illness, hence the title of the film. Whether this person is experiencing a psychotic break and is a paradigmatically devouring, not just inadequate, but devouring and annihilating mother, or is she not? And is she protecting her family from satanic forces? And I agree, that's an incredible tradition. I mean, you know, the ghost story that may or may not be a ghost story, you know, going back to Turn of the Screw by Henry James. I mean, it's a marvelous act of filmmaking virtuosity. I love the newcomers anchored by Gabriel Byrne and Toni Collette. Isaac, I am completely with you. She has been so good for so long. Toni Collette is just like one of the great actors of her generation and deserves career level recognition and ought to be in more things and be given more tasks, on-screen tasks. The problem is that it works its way towards a kind of world building, a hyper explicit explanatory world building architecture at the end, you know, and suddenly becomes a universe film. Like there's this deep mythology, there's this built out world. It explains everything that you've just seen, and everything that's ambivalent and queasy making about the movie is suddenly grounded in a fairly explicit explanation. And whether that was imposed upon the filmmaker by the studio or suddenly anxiety, and it's almost like, you know, the great young, you know, the kind of demonic gesture of being a young virtuosic talent suddenly got overwhelmed by anxiety of influence. And all of a sudden, the Polanski of Rosemary's Baby and the Friedkin of The Exorcist, and suddenly all of this kind of history of the genre comes flooding in at the end in this kind of confused way. And suddenly this young maestro is not in control of his influences. But as you say, this is a first-time writer and director. It takes no great inflation to say that this is a terrific first effort by any means, and just a compelling movie in and of itself.
Well, the director has said in interviews that he wanted to make a conspiracy movie from the point of view of the people who are being conspired against. So they don't know what's going on. And so I think that it seems baked in that. You know, that this was always part of the intention of the movie, was that it would resolve itself in the way that
sure.
it does. So I don't think it was imposed, but it's interesting because this comes at a time when we've had films like The Witch, where the core audience for the genre, which can be kind of, you know, cretinous at times, especially, you know, if you're talking about the sort of teenage boy element that wants a more kind of cookie cutterish form of storytelling and wants everything clearly explained, they really objected to the witch. They also objected that it was not, that it was more atmospheric than actually scary, which I think would probably, you know, so this film seems to be really trying to walk the line. I mean, there are some incredibly gruesome and horrific moments, so it's not for the, you know, the easily made queasy, but the core of it is the relationships in this family. And even though there is a teenager in the center of this drama, he's not depicted the way teenagers usually are in these films. I mean, he's really depicted as this kind of the way that from an adult point of view, which is he's just, when she says that he's sort of sneering at her, she's not entirely wrong. I mean, he's just this kind of pot smoking,
sullen
kid. One of the scenes that is just probably the most, or the sequences that is the most powerful, is that he has this horrible experience for which he is somewhat responsible. And he comes home and he just doesn't tell anybody. He just gets into bed and spends the night knowing that this awful thing has happened and just waiting for the rest of the world to wake up to it. And that scene is so powerful. It's really just a shot of his face. Her performance is very, you know, it's an amazing performance, but it's very much on the outside. His is very much on, is very much held in. But that is a fantastic, fantastic scene. I mean, the horror of that is a deep emotional horror that just, it was so powerful.
All right, the movie's Hereditary. It's in semi-wide release. You should go see it, check it out, and pour your ambivalences about it and our segment onto our Facebook page at facebook.com/culturefest. All right, moving on.
All right, now's the time in the show when we do the business. And first up, we have a note about the production assistant job that we discussed on last week's episode.
Hey, everybody. This is Benjamin Frisch, the producer of the show. Just wanted to say that we got a lot of really qualified candidates and applications in already. So we've closed applicant submissions now, but we're really excited to start going through the ones that we got, and we'll be contacting potential candidates soon. Thanks.
Also, a quick reminder that Summer Strut is happening soon. Send your struttiest recommendations to us on Twitter using the hashtag SummerStrut, or find our Summer Strut post on facebook.com/culturefest and leave them there. We're going to be closing submissions for these soon, too, so get on it. Also, in Slate Plus today, we're going to be talking about our summer cultural diets.
To hear segments like that and to get ad-free podcasts, sign up for Slate Plus. Slate Plus is our membership program and a great way to support us. For just $35 for your first year, you can help cover the cost of producing the Culture Gabfest and your other favorite Slate shows. And of course, in return, you'll get extended ad-free versions of this show and other great Slate shows, and a ton of other great benefits. So if you'd like to support the Culture Gabfest, go to slate.com/cultureplus and join Slate Plus today. Okay, onward.
The Staircase is a multi-episode true crime documentary. It appeared in America in 2005, over from France and French filmmakers. This was before the genre had become a thing, a genre, really. It didn't have all of the familiar tropes in place, but The Staircase helped put them there. This documentary tells the story behind the death, the possible murder, possible accident, of a North Carolina telecom executive named Kathleen Peterson, who died at the foot of a back staircase in her Durham mansion. Did she suffer a spectacular, if improbable, fall, or was she bludgeoned to death? What ensued was the trial of her husband, Michael Peterson, a novelist and ex-Marine. The documentary, in toto, is now out on Netflix. It now includes a 2013 update and three brand new, fresh episodes. Let's listen to a clip.
If somebody said to me, okay, we are going to retry you and you are going to go through all the smear again and we're going to say all this terrible shit and all this horrible stuff is going to happen, it's going to happen, going to happen, and at the end, you're going to be found not guilty and you get to go home and everything will be fine, I'd say, go ahead, beat me up for the next 2 years. I don't give a shit. Go ahead, say anything you want. I don't care. But you and I know that may not be the result of 2 years of trial. It could well be, oh, well, you're guilty again, and off I go.
Whether it's an offered plea, a no contest plea, or a guilty plea, is that to second degree, or is it to a voluntary manslaughter? I'm here to give you the options, but at the end of the day, it's your life, and you need to live it how you want to live it.
All right. Well, we should say that's the voice of David Rudolph, who was the sensational, in many ways, phlegmatic and sensational defense attorney for Michael Peterson. We're now joined by Rebecca Lavoie, who's the co-host of Mom and Dad Are Fighting. Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Hi. It's so exciting to be here.
It's exciting to have you. You are a staircase completist. I have to say that I watched this episode, lapped up every second of it when it first hit this country in 2005. Mm-hmm. I found it completely riveting. I walked away improbably thinking that Michael Peterson was innocent. And over the years, I've come to think that my former self was insane. There's no other plausible explanation for how this woman died. And yet I want to see him get off. Rebecca Lavoie, there are many confusing thoughts in my head. Sort them out for me. Describe to me your relationship with this documentary.
Well, my relationship is somewhat tied to a little bit of the point you made in your intro there that I take umbrage with about true crime genre sort of coming into its own now. It has always been a thing. It's just only now being embraced by the masses, particularly the intellectual masses now. But I've been a true crime writer since 2007, 2008 was when my first true crime book was published. And there are, you know, a lot of stories out there, and there always have been, around these kinds of cases. And my relationship with The Staircase, the reason it is so, it's such a part of my consciousness around this entire true crime storytelling stuff, is that it's unique in that it is the only episodic series, the only documentary, really, where the audience is at a point. He definitely did it. And then an hour later, I don't think he did it. And then an hour later, holy shit, what did the prosecution just do? He definitely didn't do it. And it really takes you on that journey, but it also provides a really unique look inside of a case that there's nothing comparable to. I mean, I call it the Citizen Kane of true crime for that reason. There's nothing comparable to the access you get to the defendant, to his team, to their strategy, to their meetings. And I know that people like to throw, you know, javelins at this because they say it's, you know, only one-sided, but the filmmakers in the original episodes do a very good due diligence effort in getting the prosecution's case into the narrative. And they interview the prosecutors, which is a rare opportunity. As somebody who reports on this and writes about it, like, prosecutors do not like to talk about cases that are not fully adjudicated. So that was a rare and interesting opportunity. They're in the courtroom for the whole thing, which is amazing. But I have a different conclusion than you. I don't think he did it. And I think there are some really interesting clues that point that way. So agree to disagree.
I would love to be swayed back into the innocent column for a host of reasons we'll get into. But first, for those of our audience who haven't watched The Staircase, there are two completely conflicting theories as to what happened, especially
not
in the
just
first.
Two,
there's so many different theories.
There are many, many, many theories, but essentially it comes down to, in the original show, she fell down the stairs after putting away a bottle or two of wine with her husband. He's down at the pool. She's back in the house. She slips on a top staircase in this back staircase, falls down the steps, begins to bleed profusely. He finds her alive, calls an ambulance. By the time they arrive and the police arrive, she's dead. The prosecution's theory is that he must have gotten into some kind of a conflict with her and bludgeons her to death with a blow poke.
You know, if you drink every time they say blow poke in the first eight episodes, you will be dead of alcohol poisoning by the time you're done.
It's basically a fireplace poker.
Yeah,
but it's
exactly.
Also like a stoker. I think you blow through it to stoke the fire. Right. It's like a multi-tool for your fireplace.
Right, but it's like a metal rod, not too thick.
Yeah.
Right.
Just for people who want to get a sense of what that looks like.
Yeah, so yeah, we should definitely talk about those other theories. The one of which is, of course, the most delightful, which I would love to hear Rebecca explain, is the owl theory, which is also weirdly the name of my band.
Well, what's interesting about the owl theory is it's easy to dismiss as a fringe theory. And I will give you, I think, the best resource for the owl theory that's digestible and quick is the very first episode of the podcast Criminal, which focuses on the Peterson case through the lens of the owl theory. The theory being that a barred owl, which is a large owl species known to swoop and hit people on the head with their talons.
They're bastards.
Yes, did barred exactly owls, that bastards. To Kathleen yeah. Peterson as she was walking from the pool back up to her house. The you know, support for this theory is the shape of the wounds on her scalp and the fact that there were feathers consistent with barred owl feathers found in the wounds on her head. So,
and wood splinters from a tree as well, right?
Yeah. And the theory is that she was attacked by this owl, perhaps disoriented, concussed, injured, ran into the house, went up the stairs, didn't make it, and fell down the stairs as a result of this injury. So it was the double thing of being attacked by an owl and falling down the stairs. So that is a theory. And by the way, the Audubon Society of America has kind of put their like feathers behind this theory. They think it's a decent theory because these owl attacks are surprisingly common. It just sounds so absurd. And I think it mostly sounds absurd to those skeptics who would point to the Doctrine of Chances evidence that was led into the original trial, which is that Michael Peterson also knew another woman when he lived in Germany who also was found dead at the bottom of a staircase.
Which is one of the original series' many bizarre twists, right?
Right.
It's like you think that the story that you first hear is you have this couple, they're drinking, you know, one of them dies in this mysterious way. And for the first hour, you're like, well, this seems pretty straightforward, right? And then how are they going to get 8 hours out of this? But then the weird twists of their history and of the case just keep coming. And one of them is this one, which is that when he was living in Germany, his essentially, you know, that someone else that he knew that he died of falling down a staircase.
Not only that, but then he and Kathleen adopted this woman's two orphaned daughters.
Who become main characters of the show.
Yes, and who stick by him.
Worship him.
Yes.
Worship him.
Yes.
Yeah, and then there's the other layer, which I think the last three episodes addresses completely differently in a way that kind of offends me when you compare them to the original series, is that Michael Peterson himself is not a likable guy, like, to me. This has nothing to do with, this has nothing to do with all the stuff that the prosecution puts out there, which is absurd about his bisexuality, about all these reasons why he's not trustworthy, which are total BS reasons. But he is that insufferable guy that you meet on the train or at a restaurant or like, and immediately try to extricate yourself from a conversation with. He's just obnoxious, loves the sound of his own voice, comes off as a super narcissist. And even though, like, I believe that he didn't do it, and I really want that to be true, I also acknowledge that, like, I would never want to go to dinner with this guy in a million years.
He's one of these guys that thinks that he's charming when he's not.
Right.
Yeah.
And he's, my parents had a couple of friends like this when I was a child, and they were, like, my first awareness of how someone could be, like, really making an effort to sort of make a great impression and be funny and clever and just completely have the opposite effect.
Yeah, there's this shot in the original 8 episodes. We should say that Netflix has packaged this as one season of a show. The first 8 were the ones that ran on the Sundance Network originally in like 2005, 2006. And then the new ones are the ones that are after that. There's a shot in that original group of episodes very early on of Michael Peterson lighting a pipe. And the way he does it, right before he sits down to an interview and his sort of book line study, and the way he does it, it just fills you with visceral loathing. It's a very strange thing. What I thought was so fascinating about these new episodes, though, is that there's this sort of like everyone in it has been the star of a documentary series now, and they have a certain awareness of how they are coming across that completely transforms the nature of it, because every single person is now self-consciously performing in a way they weren't before, particularly Peterson's adopted two daughters who just like, they're now adults. They now have, you know, sort of fully formed lives. And there's this sort of interesting performed filial devotion. Our father is the best thing. Let's all go to the cemetery together staginess that starts to creep into it that lends a sense of, which I think actually kind of works, but it lends a sense of untrustworthiness to the whole affair, I
right.
found.
All right. Well, I want to hear from you why you think he was, innocent.
There are a couple of things that point to it for me, but the one that sticks out the most, and the one that I always remember, and watching the original series for the first time and really doing that thing where after each episode I was going back and forth. We get as a witness for the prosecution Brad from Raleigh, which is the screen name for Brent, the escort that we find out Michael Peterson hired to have secret sexual encounters with. They had this email, this explicit email exchange between the two of them. They sort of mined Peterson's computer. And of course, they brought in his bisexuality as evidence that he wanted out of this marriage, which was crazy gay panic stuff when you see the way that the prosecutor framed it, especially the female prosecutor. Anyway, so here we have Brad from Raleigh. He's on the stand. And I like to think of him character-wise as, like, he's the Cato Kalin of the case, or could have been, right?
Clearly, yes.
He's like this, you know, outside, you know, somewhat on the margins person of the story, sitting up there like a deer in headlights. Except you have to remember, he had no idea that he was going to be a witness. Michael Peterson, when he had this encounter with this prostitute, had assumed at the time that no one was ever going to know about this, right? It was a complete secret. All of their communication was secret. Their meetings were in secret. And yet, when he had the meetup with the guy, he spent their whole date talking about how much he loved his wife and how much he, you know, this was a part of him that he needed to fulfill, but that he was really committed to his marriage and he loved his wife. Now, the prosecution's assertion that this was evidence that he wanted to get out of his marriage might hold water if Peterson had known in advance he was going to kill his wife and his plan was, I'm going to have sex with this prostitute and tell him how much I love her because someday he's going to be a witness in my murder trial. but that's not the way it worked. That was the real conversation he had with the prostitute. And to me, that points to Michael Peterson just had a secret he was keeping. I don't think Kathleen knew he was having these encounters. I think that was a stretch. But I think he had a secret he was keeping. But even in keeping that secret, he was true to himself with the guy with whom he was keeping the secret. And the truth was, he loved his wife. So I don't think he killed her. It doesn't point to that for me. As much as I don't like him, I just don't think he did it.
Isaac, you're a Shakespeare scholar. You explained to Rebecca that people kill those they love.
We did just see Othello, most
easily.
Laura and I did just go see Othello, which is, you know, surprisingly relevant to this show since it's about the unknowability of human beings and how it can lead us to kill those we're most intimate with. I always sort of held on to me. What was the interesting tension of the show was that I always felt that he probably did it, not in the way described, not for the reasons described, but maybe he shoved her down the stairs or what. They got into some drunken argument and something happened. It was not first degree murder, but it was something else. But and believing that and that he was railroaded and framed at the same time was like part of the really interesting tension of the show. I would say after the new episodes, that's probably still where I am. But what's fascinating to me about the new episodes is to me, there's like almost a shift in genre where like it's really just a tragedy now. No matter what you believed happened, the way the story unfolds and ends is unbelievably unsatisfying and devastating, right? Whether you think he did it or not, what you're left with is this group of just like intensely broken people who are obsessed with this event and obsessed with each other and can't escape from its gravity. And justice can't not actually be served in that circumstance because that truth can't ever actually be found out.
We should mention that one of the centerpieces of these two new episodes is the speech that Candace, Kathleen's sister, makes in the courtroom, where really, first of all, she accuses the film of, you know, just providing a platform for Peterson to sort of, you know, try to exonerate himself. And it's clearly like her chance to say to these filmmakers who she stresses her side of the family never cooperated with, her view of what happened. And she is this looming figure in the background because it's clear what Peterson's lawyer says, that the reason why the state is not going to cut a better deal with him is because they don't want to have to deal with the wrath of Candace. Mm-hmm. And then later...
Would you?
Yeah, no. And you think, okay, so there's part of this is that she feels that a wrong has been done and she wants justice, and she also filed a civil suit against him and she won some enormous settlement, which he can't pay because he's completely broke. And it almost seems like the main antagonist is really off of screen by the end, because she's not cooperating with the project. And so finally she gets to speak, and the whole thing has become this, like, this war between Michael Peterson and Candace. And really, like, maybe it doesn't even matter any longer what it was about. You know, it's one of those things that the conflict itself is almost self-perpetuating.
Hmm. Yeah. No, beautifully put. Rebecca, last word.
I think it's about the owl. No, I'm just... I do, though. Sorry. I'm always going to be on Team Owl on this one. I might be disappointing after your comparisons to Othello and the drama of the nuanced layered storytelling. But there is a strong possibility it was an accident of another kind. Yeah. And just all of these people with these intense personalities are the ones to bring the story our way. I mean, it's good stuff.
It's completely addictive viewing.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, people, especially if they haven't seen the original Eight, should just go right back to the beginning and binge the whole thing. Rebecca, it was awesome having you on our podcast. This has to happen again.
It was wonderful for me too. Thank you so much.
Once again, Rebecca is co-host of the Slate podcast, Mom and Dad Are Fighting, and her own joint called Crime Writers On... check them both out. All right, well, Lend Me Your Ears is the new podcast from Slate and its host and writer, Isaac Butler. Isaac, do you agree with me? Shakespeare is the ultimate humanist, therefore his work speaks to every human situation, yes or no?
That's a big statement.
I feel like you're ventriloquizing Harold Bloom.
Harold Bloom there, yeah, right? That's interesting because because Lend Me Your Ears is explicitly about politics.
Well, we were going to get there, Isaac. Yeah, sorry. After answering the yes or no question.
That's a very complicated yes or no question. I would say for the most part, sure.
Okay, well, you'll go with it. All right. This, as you say, is a podcast about politics, Shakespeare and politics. So I have another question for you. Does this analogy hold, that just as Shakespeare would use ancient history to explore with a degree of safety Elizabethan or Jacobean intrigue, so too, sir, I accuse you of using Shakespeare, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, that's exactly right. The difference is that I can't be jailed for talking about contemporary politics
yet.
For my stage. Yet. Yeah, exactly. And Shakespeare could. I mean, what's really fascinating to me about Shakespeare is because he couldn't comment on his era directly from the stage and he couldn't stage current events, he had to reach into these other stories, folk tales, short stories he had read, myths, Plutarch's Lives, you know, all the history of his own nation. And within those, you know, because he couldn't talk about actual current events explicitly, he was able to dramatize thematically what was going on in politics. And even though our society is very different from the early modern era in London, those same struggles and those same ideas are deeply enmeshed in our politics. And every generation is going to rediscover Shakespeare's plays and what they mean. I wanted to be a little bit of a part of that when it came to politics, you know, in part because I was trying to understand our own era better, but do it not just in ways that studied our own time, but sort of talked about the timeless political themes that we are struggling with.
All right. Well, before we dig in any further, why don't we listen to a clip?
The conspirators kill Caesar on the floor of the Senate. Caesar cries out, "Et tu, Brute?" When it's over, as the conspirators dip their hands in the blood of Caesar and spread it on their arms, they are approached by Mark Antony. Once he realizes they aren't going to kill him, Antony asks if he can make a speech to the people, and Brutus makes his third error. He agrees to it. This gives us the play's majestic centerpiece, the competing orations of Brutus and Mark Antony over the body of Caesar. It's a competition that Brutus will lose.
Isaac, it's a wonderful podcast, and I love the choice of Julius Caesar. And you say something that is just extraordinary. You say that Brutus believes in reason, and that reason will prevail before the people, and that he believes that he's going to be able to justify the assassination to the people using reason, and that this points to a certain theory of political violence, which is that it's acceptable when the cause is just, and acceptable when it can be contained ex post facto by this appeal to the reason of the people. And in this respect, Brutus is Obama, a kind of a tragic figure. I mean, not that Obama believed in this theory of political violence necessarily, but Obama did believe that he could appeal directly to the American people, to the better part of their conscience, and turns out to be tragically wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I really genuinely believe that. I should say about Obama, I mean, I think I include a little caveat that it's like all presidents, right? Like American presidents, one thing that American presidents believe, and actually most Americans believe that I'm not sure I believe, is that you can murder your way to solving certain problems or kill your way to solving certain problems. And then you can sort of like put that genie back in the bottle. And I think as our recent post 9/11 history shows, that's just fundamentally untrue. Like those problems cannot be solved that way. When you do that, you create further oppositional forces, and we end up in this sort of intractable situation. Now, what Brutus is doing is something a little bit different, which is assassinating a friend slash political rival who's about to take over the state. But the same thing remains, which is that he feels like if you have the right values, there are certain tactics that can become justifiable. And then, you know, because those are conditionally limited to certain circumstances, you can just be sort of call ollie ollie oxen free and move on. And one of the reasons why I turned to Julius Caesar was it's sort of to do first was that, you know, I was this podcast, we started working on it almost a year ago now. There were a lot of moments where I was reading my friends being like, yeah, we should just go punch Richard Spencer in the face, or, you know, whatever it was. And I just kept thinking about Julius Caesar and being like, guys, once you start doing that, it doesn't end well. And the people it doesn't end well for are usually actually leftists. So, you know, like maybe we should try something else. And that was kind of what led me there, actually.
Hmm. It's kind of notable that one of the reasons why people think that is because that is a major theme of American popular culture is redemptive violence.
Yeah.
And in a way, you almost have to go to Shakespeare to find the point of view that says, you know, that says, hold on, you can't kill your way to virtue.
Yeah, I really genuinely believe, and will happily argue with anyone about this anytime they want, that Shakespeare abhorred violence and was incredibly frightened of it and found it to be terrible, even though he rarely stages the kind of baroque gruesome sequences of his Jacobean peers and the people who came immediately after him, except in King Lear, where someone's eyes get gouged out and stepped on stage. I really believe that Shakespeare abhorred violence and did not, and was freaked out by it, and that's really present there in his plays. Even Henry V, which is supposedly the great patriotic play, contains all sorts of sequences about how that make it very clear that Henry is embarking on this war for political gain, that there's sort of no principle behind it, that these people are dying for nothing. He has one of his best friends from Henry IV hanged. You know, there's a real suspicion about violence and power that runs throughout his body of work.
Talk now a little bit about Richard II, which is the second play that you delve into. It has a somewhat unique status in the Shakespeare canon that maybe made it apposite to where we are now.
It's another deposition play.
Yeah. It's another play where the succession from one ruler to another goes horribly awry, which Shakespeare wrote a lot of, in part because we forget this because the succession from Queen Elizabeth to James I was smooth-ish. But in the decade leading up to it, Elizabeth wouldn't let anyone publicly talk about the succession. She had no kids, and it was clear that she was going to die. And so, you know, people were really freaked out about it. And there's a lot of plays, not just by Shakespeare, where successions go awry. Laura was actually a guest for our Slate Plus episode about Richard II, in part because she's such a War of the Roses enthusiast. What I was really interested in about that play which is not as well known or as often performed as Julius Caesar, has fewer famous scenes and lines, and is about more obscure historical figures. But what was interesting to me about that was this idea of, like, how does the person in charge lose legitimacy and how do they gain it, right? And I think in the wake of an election where a president was elected by the minority, right? He did not win the plurality of the votes. And there was almost certainly some form of election interference that you know, he and his cronies participated in, and, you know, et cetera, and so forth. And we have people saying, he's not my president, right? What does that mean to say not my president? And what are the implications for the system? And what are the risks to us going forward when we start to lose faith in not only the people who run the system, but the system itself? You know, like, what does it mean to have to sit through the post-Neil Gorsuch Supreme Court? You know, for a lot of Democrats, that seat was stolen from Merrick Garland, and through an illegitimate process, even though it was legally correct, it was illegitimate. And so what does it mean that we have all of these rulings now that would have been completely different, you know, had it had a legitimate process, et cetera? And so I was really fascinated by those questions. And those are really complicated, difficult questions to ask. And I think Richard II is a play that sort of really beautifully deals with them.
The thing about Richard II is that he is so insupportable to the aristocrats who are responsible for taking him off the throne, that that it seems worthwhile to get rid of him. But then again, something is irredeemably broken when they do, which is, as you say, the legitimacy of any king's reign. Once you decide that the process by which someone becomes the ruler or the president or whatever, it can be equivocated with, you know, can maybe it doesn't really count or anything like that. You then leave your guy vulnerable to the same sort of insecurity. And I think it's true that Shakespeare did dread this because, you know, when we look back, we don't realize that his time was so much more violent than our own. There's a kind of a presentism that makes people think that we live in the most violent time ever. But we're talking about people who routinely saw public executions in the city streets and who were coming out of a kind of whiplash period of religious conflict where, well, we're all Protestants now. No, we're all Catholics again. No, we're Protestants again.
And not only are we Protestants, but if you're like, you know, if you're secretly distributing Catholic literature, we are going to literally rip you apart in front of a crowd.
Yeah. So this was, you know, a really disturbing period to live through. I mean, I can imagine very frightening. And I think that as much as we feel like we're living in a condition of like unprecedented chaos, we don't really realize what it's like to live in a country whose whole system of governance is just sort of teetering.
All right. So predict the future of the American Republic by telling me what the future episodes of Lend Me Your Ears are going to focus on.
So our next episode, which will air on the second Tuesday of July, it's the second Tuesday of every month through October. Our next episode is about King Lear, where a screwed up succession kind of destroys the entire world. So that's great. No, but you know, we've sort of talked about two other succession crises. So in King Lear, we're going to talk a lot more about the nature of power and how power and entitlement come to resemble insanity, because I really think that's one of the things going on in that play. After that, we move on to Measure for Measure, because I wanted to sort of talk about other things about politics rather than the legislative process. We move on to Measure for Measure, which is kind of the Me Too of Shakespeare plays. It's a play where a nun comes to plead for her brother's life because he's going to be executed for having premarital sex. And the sort of acting duke that she comes to plead to says, okay, I will let him go if you have sex with me. And then when she says, I'll tell everyone that you threatened me this, he says, in the most timeless of Shakespeare's lines, Who will believe thee? So that's Measure for Measure. It's a comedy, weirdly. After that is Othello, which is where we'll be sort of probing the nature of identity and otherness. And we return to ancient Rome with the final play, Coriolanus, which is a really brilliant, brilliant, amazing play that sort of no one ever reads. There's a great recent film of it directed by and starring Ralph Fiennes as Coriolanus, which is about the sort of rivalry between the common people who are trying to gain more political representation in the system and a heroic general who is running for consul, which is a kind of like the executive branch of Rome, who is a man of such deep principle that he won't moderate the principle that he absolutely hates the poor. And it is about the conflict between those two political forces. It's about the populism versus elitism, essentially. And it's a conflict in which neither side comes out looking particularly great. So after sort of probing these other angles of politics, we'll return to, you know, the government and how it functions with the final episode.
The current catastrophe.
All right. Well, the podcast is Lend Me Your Ears. It's Isaac Butler's baby. Make it yours too. Adopt it. It's wonderful. It is really good, Isaac. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
All right. Now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse. Laura, what do you have?
I want to recommend a book by Johann Hari called Lost Connections, which is about the science of depression. And it's sort of a debunking book about antidepressants. And it's gotten a lot of pushback. He has a somewhat shadowed reputation because he has some plagiarism accusations in his past. But that has been, I think, used against a book that is itself pretty, you know, pretty thoroughly documented. And it's basically him saying why, if most researchers and many, many psychiatrists believe that antidepressants are actually not that effective or effective only in so few cases, do we still have as the dominant paradigm that depression is caused by a chemical imbalance in your brain, which is something that if you're at all knowledgeable about the issue, nobody believes that anymore. And an exploration of other ways of dealing with depression or seeing depression as a symptom of a larger cultural, social, and in many cases just life problems. And I found it very persuasive. I think that there's been some pushback in the press from professional figures who feel attacked by it, but I found them really unpersuasive in it, and it has disappointed me that so many people have sort of just gone with, in particular, a negative piece in The Guardian, which I thought was really, really weak in refuting the book, and also was written by someone who hadn't even read the book. I think it's worth checking out, even if you don't agree with all of it. It's a really impassioned, really, you know, energetically researched book on a problem that touches a lot of people. And very well written as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think that we've been reductively causal about depression for a generation now. And an intelligent argument pushing back on that and thinking about the social and structural causes that make people endemically unhappy with their life and modern life was long overdue. I think I've only read about half the book. I think he did a terrific job. But I want to point out also, Laura, he's done a very good job of being, first of all, open about his past transgressions, and secondly, very transparent in responding to criticism about the book and his own sourcing online. So to the extent that people have gone after him in the press, he's been quite responsive and quite to criticism and open to criticism in ways that I think were admirable. So I'm very psyched that you endorsed that book.
Great.
Isaac, what do you have?
I have two albums that I've just been listening to on repeat lately that I think might help people get through this suddenly, if you're on the East Coast, extremely hot and muggy summer. We've gone from like 65 degree days to 90 degree days, and maybe these on your headphones will make it go a little easier. The first is an album that came out, I believe, last year by a group called Japanese Breakfast, which is the solo side project of a singer-songwriter named Michelle Zauner.
That's not
And that album is called Soft Sounds from Another Planet. Now, Japanese Breakfast is working with a lot of different influences that don't always feel like they should go together. There's a lot of can in there. There's a lot of shoegaze. They're also, you know, going in a kind of Phil Spector-y direction sometimes. There's a bit of sort of all those influences that you hear in early Bell and Sebastian Camera Obscura as well. So, and the end result is kind of like a dreamier end of the bands you hear in the Roadhouse in Twin Peaks, you know?
Those are pretty dreamy to begin with.
Yeah, exactly. Well, but it's supposed to the Nine Inch Nails end. It's okay. More in the sort of dream poppier end. And I discover new things every time I listen to it. She's got a really great voice. She's a really badass guitarist. I just think it's a really good album that people should listen to. And then the other one is this new album by Anjali Kidjo, who's a singer, songwriter, and activist originally from Benin. And she has done this full album cover of Talking Heads' Remain in Light that is effing mind-blowing. I mean, Remain in Light is like one of my favorite albums of all time. I have a feeling it's probably on the top 10 of a lot of Gabfest listeners. And it's heavily, the original album is heavily influenced by, you know, African music, by Afrobeat and polyrhythms and stuff like that. And, you know, Anjali Kidjo kind of reclaims this album and brings it firmly back into an African pop sensibility. And the results are stunning. She and David Byrne have performed it live together, I think, at Carnegie Hall last year before she recorded it. And it's really, really stunning. In particular, I'm a particular fan of she takes Listening Wind, which is a kind of spooky but sort of somewhat filler track from the second half of the album, and she just makes it into this like incredible odyssey. And her cover of Born Under Punches is like a straight up banger and should be the song of the summer.
Laura, while I have you here, I have to ask, are you perchance a Borgesian?
Are you asking if I enjoy the fiction of Jorge Luis Borges?
All right. Well, the reason I ask is that many years ago, a friend of mine delivered a supremely beautiful eulogy for a classmate of ours who had been prematurely lost. And excuse me. And he quoted in it two Borges essays. The essay is A History of Eternity and A New Refutation of Time. I finally got around many years later to reading them. They're like everything Borges wrote, apparently. I mean, they're astonishing in their virtuosity, in their erudition, in their playfulness, in their ability to kind of invert all the presuppositions of your own mind, the architecture of your own assumptions, but also swoonily beautiful and lyrical. I mean, he just is one of a handful of people to whose name is just indicates not only a genre, but a way of looking at the world and being in the world, right? Along with Kafka, there's Borges, you know, you could argue, I don't know, Wittgenstein, Shakespeare, obviously, I mean, Nabokov, anyway, he's a giant of that stature, and re-entering the stream of his thought with these two essays to me was among the most satisfying reading experiences I've had in years. Let me just quickly read from A History of Eternity. The passage of the Aeneids that seeks to question and define the nature of time states that a prior acquaintance with eternity is indispensable since, as everyone knows, eternity is the model and archetype of time. He goes on to say, we read in Plato's Timaeus that time is a moving image of eternity, and it barely strikes a chord, distracting no one from the conviction that eternity is an image wrought in the substance of time. I propose to give a history of that image, that awkward word, enriched by human discord. And he just goes on from there. And it's never has a human being worn such depth of knowledge and reading so lightly, sort of played on the fiddle of everything that's ever been thought or said with such dexterity and ease. And by the end of it, you feel a million times enhanced. So Borges is one of those writers who suffers from being easy enough to read when you're 18 or 20 years old. You have your mind blown and then you sort of move on. Don't move on. Go back to it. Go back. Find some new way in. I'm telling you, it is just a powerfully rewarding experience. So that's A History of Eternity and A New Refutation of Time, both of which are miraculous, both of which are on the internet. Laura, thank you so much for coming in and filling in. You were terrific as always.
It's great to be with you.
Isaac, you were merely average.
Well, you know, I did my best.
No, you were spectacular, and it was wonderful
thank
to
you,
have
Steve.
You back on the show.
It's always a pleasure.
No, you were spectacular. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest. You can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/culturefest. We do have a Twitter feed. It's @SlateCultFest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our production assistant is Daniel Schrader. For Laura Miller and Isaac Butler, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you soon.